the James. A whole lot of tears. Don't try to figure out who was wrong and who was right. Got to move along, baby. Go with the flow. Roll with the punches. Yeah, that's one thing I know.
Yeah, you gotta roll with the punches. Hi, everybody. Your old friend Mike Houlihan. Welcome back to Hibernian Radio. We're brought to you by McCann's Irish Oatmeal, Cork and Kerry Irish Pub, Fox's Pizza, Flood Brothers, and Guinness. Guinness is good for you. Another great night here at Cork and Kerry. We're every night, Saturday night, from 7 to 8 on WSBC, 1240 AM. Also podcast globally at HibernianRadio.org. And our guest tonight, a very special guest, and he brought a huge fan club, and we're very appreciative of that, is Jimmy Sherlock. Jimmy, welcome to the show, pal.
Thanks, Uli. Thank you for having me.
30 years on the job. Carmel guy. Fellow Carmel guy. So we're going to take you back now to St. Adrian's.
Oh, boy.
Let's go back there.
Marquette Park.
Yeah, and that's where you grew up. You played football, baseball, and boxing at Carmel. You went to you played football. You're a huge guy.
Yeah.
what position do you? Oh, you were a quarterback.
I was a quarterback at Carmel, yeah. Quarterback.
Wow. Who was your coach?
Bill Bars.
Ah, he was the best.
Bill Bars was a great guy.
The real deal.
He was.
Absolutely.
He is.
Yeah. At least it wasn't that other guy. And you know who I'm talking about.
Yeah.
The L word. well, anyway, so you went to Carmel. You have a family history at Carmel,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
Tell us about that.
My grandfather. Yeah, my grandfather graduated in 1936.
Wow.
And my father graduated in 59, and both his brothers, Bill and Tom, also went to Mount Carmel. And then I graduated in 82, and both my sons are Carmel grads, and my daughter currently teaches at Mount Carmel.
I sent my sons to Carmel, too.
Yeah, good school.
And we were living in River Forest at the time. I said no.
Yeah.
And all our Fenwick friends were afraid of them then. It worked out great.
Well,
the first time we played Fenwick, we kicked their butts.
That's
terrific.
Good. That's good. But now, my dad, Hooley, lived five houses away from St. Rita High School.
St. Rita, yeah.
And he went to Mount Carmel.
Yeah.
And I asked him years later, because my dad was a man of very few words, and I asked him years later, I said, Dad, you know, why did you go to Carmel when you had St. Rita literally, you know, 30 seconds away? He said, that was convenient. It was convenient, and I said, and that was all I got out of him. So that's the way that conversation
went. He was saying, don't go for the convenience.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and he was a big football star.
Yeah, he was All-State at Carmel, and then he went on and played at Notre Dame.
What year did he get out of Carmel?
Out of Carmel?
Yeah.
59.
Because I remember I was a kid, I saw the 1960 City Championship, and that's why I decided to go to Carmel. I was there at Soldier Field with Tony Carey.
Well, Tom was like 50 or 51.
Oh, yeah, he was a coach.
Tony Carey.
Tony Carey, yeah. Buddy Rule.
Buddy Rule. I know Buddy Rule.
Yeah.
I knew Buddy well, yeah.
What a character. I miss him.
Yeah, it was a good man.
All right, so, and then you played football at Purdue.
Well, I went there.
Okay.
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to earn a scholarship.
Were you a quarterback still?
Oh, well, I went there as a quarterback, and then I ended up playing defensive back. They had a guy there named Jim Everett.
Oh, yeah,
so
sure.
So I was not going to do anything there.
Yeah.
So I played defensive back, but it was a fun time.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And then did you go right into the police force when you got out of college?
No, I was out of college, I went to work for the county. I was a deputy sheriff when O'Grady was the sheriff.
Oh, okay, so you went to the sheriff's police.
Yeah, I was there for a year. Then I went to Metro. I was a cop with Metro, Rock Island.
The train,
I worked there for just about a year before I went to the academy in 89 for CPD.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So were you, and now you're at the state's attorney's police, right?
Yeah, I was state's attorney investigator.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. It was a good job. I was fortunate to get that. It's a nice job. I was too young to go into retirement.
I don't blame you.
Yeah.
Okay, so 30 years gang crime officer, homicide detective, 12 years of the U.S. Marshals Fugitive
Task Force.
Wow. Right. Did you happen to know Jimmy Smith, by the way?
Very well.
Really?
Yeah, I knew Jimmy before I was a policeman.
He's married to my niece, Margaret.
Really?
Yeah.
I know Margaret well.
Yeah.
I was at the wedding.
Yeah. So was I, I think.
Yeah. I was there. Yeah.
Okay.
South Side, right?
Yes, absolutely. And then you were with the FBI Violent Crimes Homicide Task Force.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
I was there for my last 4 years in the job. That's how I went out. I was working on a task force, and the supervisor there, Mike Brown, another Southsider, brother Rice guy, he put me basically working cold case because he knew I only had 4 years left.
Yeah.
And a lot of their investigations go a long time.
Yeah.
So he put me off on my own with another detective named Dan McNally from the neighborhood here. We both were working cold case.
Okay. So you have a long history of Mount Carmel and a long time on the job. But then there's another interesting thing that pops out.
Yeah.
You are the director of security for 16 years with the Jerry Springer Show.
Yeah, yeah, that was...
That was quite a circus, I'm sure. Now, was this while you were a cop?
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. I was working a side job downtown Chicago at the Baja Beach Club.
And
I was working with Steve Wilkos. And
oh, yeah.
Steve, we were working late one night, and Steve goes, "Hey, what are you doing tomorrow morning?" And you know, I'm like, "Well, what do you got going on?" He's like, "Well, I got a side job at the NBC Tower." So I just thought it was security or something.
Yeah.
I go, "All right, I'll be there." So when I walked in, I literally, within an hour, was on a stage and we were practicing what we were going to do, and I still didn't know what was going on.
Yeah.
I never heard of the Jerry Springer Show.
Yeah.
And it was already, it was already on for a year.
Because you have some decency and morality in your life.
But it was already on for a year.
Yeah.
But it was more of the format was like Phil Donahue.
Yeah.
So the show got canceled. The show was not going to come back.
Oh, Jerry Springer?
Yeah. It wasn't. And then the executive producer, Richard Dominick, told the company that owned the show, "Just give me a few months, and I'll change this around."
Yeah.
So they said, "Well, we paid the lease for the studio. You know, go at it."
Yeah.
So it took them a few weeks, and that's when I was up on stage. We were doing all kinds of stuff, trying to. I still didn't know what we were going to do.
Yeah.
I don't think they did either.
Yeah.
Then all of a sudden, we filmed the show with a live audience
that
never made the air.
Yeah.
But it was just craziness, and I was.
Oh, it never made the what never
the first show.
Oh, okay.
And I was real smart. I said, "This show's never going to make it."
Yeah.
And then 26 years later, they went off the air. You know.
So, well, it's a circus,
yeah,
basically.
Yeah, it was crazy. It was crazy. Jerry was a good man. No, is a good man.
He's a former mayor of Cleveland or something?
Cincinnati.
Okay.
Uh-huh. He's a good man. The executive producer, Richard Dominick.
Isn't that show still on, though? I thought it
just ended. I think last year, I think it ended.
Oh, okay.
He moved out of Chicago, Hooley. He moved to Connecticut.
Oh, okay.
Something to do with taxes, and they got.
But now Steve Wilkos has a show.
Steve got his own show off the Springer Show, yeah.
It's the same
show. And
shtick,
I think he's
basically.
Still on.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, he's saving the world one juvenile delinquent at a time.
One unmarried mother at a time.
Yeah, he's saving the world.
Yes.
But he's still on, so he's doing good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that must have been fun. You're a police. Did you ever have to arrest anybody who had been on your show?
Well, several guests on our show were arrested downtown Chicago. It's hard to believe, right?
That's great.
So if they knew they had to get three stories, the producers would usually bring in four. Because they knew one story was going to get locked up the night before the show or get so drunk that they wouldn't be able to be on the show.
Yeah.
So they would always plan ahead. The producers were really good at what they did. And they got better as the years went on.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, okay, we need X amount of guests, so we better get a few extra just so we can fill the time. You know.
Now, would people sign up to come on the show? I mean,
no, actually what would happen is people would leave messages. And then they would have these assistant producers would listen to hours and hours of messages.
Yeah.
And when they got to a story that they felt would be good for the show, they would jump on it.
Yeah.
And they would bring the people here and produce them.
Were they all from Chicago?
No.
No?
Very few people from Chicago. They mostly Ohio. I don't want to badmouth Ohio, but Ohio, Pennsylvania, and then the South. A lot of people from Missouri.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they were down there. And they looked at it as a way to get out of wherever they're at.
Get out of town for a while.
To get to Chicago and stay in a hotel for 2 days.
Ooh, Chicago.
With indoor plumbing and everything.
Oh, man.
It was fun. Like I said, Jerry took real good care of all the policemen that worked there.
There was
quite a few of us.
How many cops were there working on that show?
Well, it started out, it was just four of us.
Yeah.
Steve and I, and then Danny and Mike McDermott, and then but then he just got bigger. And then when I took over, I brought all my people in.
Yeah,
I brought there was always four or five policemen that were there. Brought my son Jimmy. He worked down there.
Oh, cool.
He was a copper. He worked down there with me, and it was good. It was just, I was taking advantage of a very good situation, trying to spread the wealth of friends of mine.
Well, you went to Carmel. You're probably used to some people like that.
Yeah. Yeah, when I say I wasn't a guest, I worked on a show.
Okay, so now I want you to tell me the story about your dad and let me just get my magnifying glass out here. He went to Carmel, many friends in St. Rita. You live minutes from St. Rita. You played quarterback. Oh, George Sherlock. Your great-great-grandfather.
My great-grandfather, yeah. And I didn't know this until my Uncle Tom had passed away about 6 months ago.
Yeah.
And when he passed away, my Uncle Bill received all his information from my Uncle Tom's apartment in Vegas. That's where he was living. So in this box, there was a picture in there with my great-grandfather, George Sherlock. It was in the back of the picture said 1905. First St. Rita football team, George Sherlock.
It's
a picture of the
football. Yeah, first
team. I
didn't
even know he went to St. Rita.
Yeah.
It was the first team, first team they ever had. And no one ever told me that.
Wow.
And we had a big St. Rita Mount Carmel, rivalry because we were all so close.
Anyway. Oh, that's what the thing.
Right.
The one you kicked the field goal against Rita.
Big win
to beat
me.
Them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was something else. Yeah.
That's great. Yeah. The Mustangs. Well, they're still around.
There's a couple here right now.
A couple of Rita Mustangs, yeah.
Yeah. They got lost coming up here. Yeah.
Okay, so now I'm going to get back to your career, but you're also the primary story in a book that just came out called Murder in Canaryville by Jeff Cohen. Tell us about that.
Well, that's a few-hour story, but basically what behind that, Huli, is I was working cold case with the FBI. I was CPD detective assigned to the FBI task force, and a retired Chicago detective, Tommy Argenbright, had called the office because he heard I was working there, myself and Dan McNally, and he left this long story about a case we should work. And it was a choir director from St. Anthony's was killed tragically in like 1984. So after I investigated that case, which is crazy, I basically told Argenbright, I called him and I said, listen, Tom, I can't do this. There's just too many twists and turns and a lot of people are dead and it's just going to be crazy. He goes, okay, well, here you go. And he gives me an RD number and he says, how about this case?
Oh, he gave you another one?
He gave me another one, John Hughes. So that's how I started it.
Ah.
And then from there on, it was a total roller coaster.
So you weren't from Bridgeport.
No.
But you...
No, I have a lot of people I know there.
Yeah.
Just through softball. And
would he have been the same age as you?
No. John Hughes would have graduated in 76.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, only 6 years older than you.
Yeah.
But there's an Irish Catholic thing there.
Yes.
I'm sure you can.
Yeah, he went to De La Salle, played football. Yeah. He was actually the president of his class.
Yeah, I heard great things about him.
Yeah, everybody, I've talked to probably over 50 people, actually more than that, in this investigation. The first thing everybody says is, man, he was a great guy. And that was people from Bridgeport and Canaryville. They all.
And it was basically an Italian-Irish fight.
Just a fist fight. It was a fight.
Somebody pulled out a gun.
There was a fight at a party over on 30th and Troop. They left 30th and Troop. They went over to 31st and Halstead. There was a small fight there. Just a couple guys fought. Nobody got hurt bad.
Yeah.
And then everybody went back to their parks, Boyce Park for the Canaryville and McGuane Park for Bridgeport. And a car pulled up at Boyce Park at about 1:15 in the morning, and driving by real slow. Kids from Canaryville started walking towards the car, and one shot came from the car.
Killed him.
Hit John in the chest and killed him immediately.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was very sad.
And then it was covered up for years and years.
They did a heck of a job doing that, too. And I think the detectives back in 76 did a tremendous job. But, back then, before computers, when you would do a report, you put it in a bin.
Yeah.
And then it goes from that bin to this bin to that bin. And there's a few bins that were missing.
Sure.
Where reports ended up not getting to where they were supposed to be.
Yeah.
Some reports that may have closed this case real quick.
So. And the book is on Amazon now?
It's on Amazon, yeah.
Anybody can get
it.
Any talk of any film deals on that book? Or
well, I have been hearing some rumblings about a Netflix show. Yeah.
Oh, and, that's cool.
There's a producer from Netflix that is, he's very interested in this, and I'm going to be meeting with him next week
to
discuss the possibilities,
Oh, that's terrific.
Yeah.
And so it's based on you doing this cold case, and
I was the only one that was investigating it at the time, so it's based on my investigation. But then there's several other people that are involved. The author did a good job that he brought the original investigating detective from 1976. He interviewed him.
Oh, no kidding.
Which is a great interview because I also interviewed him, Terry Strong.
Yeah.
Good man.
Yeah.
So many of the other detectives that investigate the case have passed away.
Yeah.
So and there's a few detectives that I really would have loved to talk to because I knew that they knew a lot more than any other detectives did.
They knew what was up.
They knew what was going on.
Yeah. And
they'd been through that game before.
Yeah.
Terry Strong was a new detective, so he was kind of shocked when, a high-ranking police official ripped a report out of his hand and walked it over to Mayor Daley's house.
Wow.
To check it. He was surprised that happened, and one of the old-timers was like, kid, that ain't nothing. That's just business. Business as usual.
Yeah.
So,
Okay, so many 30 years on the job. Got any particular stories you want to tell us?
No, my wife's here. Oh, those stories.
Oh, you gave yourself away right there.
Yeah. No, I got so many stories, just like so many policemen. If you're on the job that long, you've got.
Yeah.
I mean, I used to always read, Joseph Wamba, read his.
Oh, sure.
His novels, and my stories were better than his, and I'm sure most Chicago coppers would say the same thing.
That's why we do this show.
Yeah, every day. I mean, old time coppers, nothing better than them. I've did 30 years in a circus, and they have so many cool sayings. But I was really fortunate when I got on the job. There were still a lot of the old coppers left.
Yeah.
Like when I came on in 89, I had a lot of guys, the Vietnam vets that were
still
on the job.
We've had a few of them on the show.
And I worked in an undercover unit downtown Chicago for a few years, and three of the guys on my team were involved in the war, and it was just really cool being around them and learning from them because they were good. They were the best. So it was, but my stories, the guys I talked to, like Johnny Pellegrini just left, he was a guy I used to work with. Our stories were never about making arrests or this. It was always about the funny stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, that's we'd go hang out at Dugan's or go hang out at Ira's or somewhere like that.
Dugan's on Halston?
Dugan on Halston. Ira's was on Madison. I think. And later on, we used to go to Chili over on, that was on Madison as well. But we just go there and nobody sits around patting themselves on the back or anything like that. Everything was like, hey, guess what happened tonight? So-and-so dropped his gun, and he called the police and said he found a gun on the scene. Let's inventory this thing. And somebody said, where's your gun? He's looking around and goes, that actually happened. Capper thought he found a gun, and it was his. But this is a funny story because my Angie, my wife, loves the story. We're working just a regular day in Englewood, and my partner and I.
Englewood? That's next to Carmel.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So we saw two guys on the street, just a regular thing. We're going to make a traffic stop. One guy takes off running. He takes off running. My partner runs after him. The other guy in the car, the other guy runs. I'm the passenger. I take off running. So I tackle my guy, and I'm on the ground tackling him, wrestling around the ground. Then I see my partner, who was the driver, he tackles the guy next to me. So now we got them both. We're on the ground, and the fight's going. It's going pretty good. And the guy I'm fighting with goes, hey, and I look. He goes, look it. And there goes the squad car. It's just with the both
watching.
Doors are wide open, and the squad car is just
your car.
Yeah. And it went through Marquette Road, which is a busy street.
Yes.
It went right through Marquette without hitting anybody. And then went up on a curb, went up on the grass, and came to a quiet stop against a tree with no damage. So we let those two guys
like
go.
Like your horse.
Yeah,
you let them go because... Yeah.
Got back in the car, laughed our asses off, and it was just funny, Yeah,
hey,
funny
you better look over there.
Yeah. The other same guy, we used to have a code word that if you sense trouble, I'm not going to say, hey, gun. So we had a code, and our code word was, I need your flashlight.
I need your flashlight.
I need your flashlight. So we got two guys in a trunk. I open the trunk up, and my partner Jerry, he's next to him, and he's talking to both of them.
And
I'm looking in the trunk, and I see a couple guns, and I see like four or five pillowcases full of marijuana. And that's a lot. And that's a lot.
Yeah.
So I look at Jerry. I go, hey, Jerry, give me your flashlight. Jerry leaves, goes in the car, gets his flashlight, and in the meantime, the two guys
They're gone.
See you later. I grab the flashlight, and I'm like,
you idiot. Don't you remember the code word?
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. And I was the same partner.
Okay, so you've been through all this. Now, you're still in law enforcement.
Yes.
And one of the reasons we do this show is we believe that the Irish first responders are the modern-day equivalent to our Irish mythological warriors. Mm-hmm. Right now they're taking a lot of heat. It's a tough time to be a cop. Any reflections on that?
Well, we got a very good friend of mine, Johnny Catanzaro's here today.
Yeah.
I'm glad we have him fighting for us right now.
Yeah.
I mean, if he wasn't in office, I don't know what. We might have somebody sitting there right now agreeing with what's going on.
Oh,
but John's going to fight for all the policemen,
you know,
all the old guys, the young guys, everybody. And it's a shame what's going on right now. It's a shame, yeah. The morale has been low for a few years in the police department, but I think recently I think it's at an all-time low now. I mean, guys.
Last week we were doing the show, at 3 o'clock in the morning passed this bogus bill in Springfield.
Yeah, that's what criminals do. Criminals
do
stuff
exactly.
Right
they work in the dark. And,
they work
know,
in the dark,
it's awful.
Yeah. I'd like to know their reasoning for that. I mean, I heard all kind of things. They only had so many hours to pass it. That's all
BS.
Yeah, that's all BS. If they had to do it, they should have done it a few days in advance. But they wanted to get it passed.
Well, they didn't want the spotlight.
They didn't want the spotlight. Yeah, for once, they don't want the spotlight on something.
Yeah.
So,
remember their names, though.
Unfortunately, in this state, they keep getting elected.
Yeah, that's terrible. And I'm sure. Did he already sign it, Pritzker?
No, not yet.
Okay. Well, and there's still time to make a call, folks.
Yeah, you definitely can.
We're also under an awful lot of censorship right now. I was just, they discontinued one of my favorite sites, Second City Cop.
I know.
And that's just downright criminal.
Yeah.
Of no free speech. And they're clamping down on the police pretty bad.
They certainly are. And if you're a policeman nowadays, you probably shouldn't have social media, especially if you're a young copper.
You shouldn't be on there.
You shouldn't be on social media.
Yeah.
Because no matter what you, there's no such thing as deleting anything.
No, forget it.
If they want to go after you, they can always go after you, and they can bring up whatever you've done in the past. And even if you meant something as a joke, you can get suspended.
Oh, I'd be in jail if I had. If I was.
Well, I think of some of the things we did years ago. All of us would be in jail. There wouldn't be any police out there.
Now, one thing, though, that encourages me, and I ask everybody on the show this, and one guy said, why would anybody want to be a cop these days? And he said, you got to have the good guys.
Yeah.
Got to have them.
That's a great response.
Yeah.
You do need those good coppers. And both my sons are here, and they're both police officers, and you still need those guys out there that are going to do something, because there's still a lot of good people who are victims in these neighborhoods.
Absolutely.
And those are the people you never hear from. When you turn the news on, they got these buffoons on there who are loud, and the media is all around. But the real victims who appreciate the police, they don't want them on TV.
No.
They skip right over them. They go right to the loudmouths who get all the attention.
Sure.
I mean, I've walked past, and I'm sure Johnny Catanzaro will agree with me on this, I've walked past demonstrations, they call them demonstrations, like out in front of a district. There's like six people demonstrate.
And they make
there's
it look
more
like
there's media people there than demonstrators.
Yeah.
But if you watch it on the news that night,
sure they make
it looks like there's a bunch of them out there.
Yeah.
They got a way of doing it. So you got six or seven people beefing about something, and every news channel's out there. And of course, what they're beefing about is a lie.
Yes.
It's all turned around, upside down. It's not the truth.
Yeah.
The truth doesn't matter anymore.
The truth is dead. Journalism is dead. That's
Journalism
what I think.
Is definitely dead.
Yeah.
Good journalism, said.
All right, I want you to think back and come back to me with one of your favorite all-time stories. Now, you have a lot of great partners, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You want to tell any stories on them?
Yeah. I've been real lucky. I've had, Johnny Foley, Will Svilar, Scotty Rakovich. I went from one good partner to the next. I've been real, real fortunate. Real smart guys.
Yeah.
I was always the dumbest one in the car, I'll tell you that. It wasn't hard. They were always real good. And I was also in some good units, which I was fortunate for that as well. So I got to do some real police work with some real good people.
Now, you're working for the state's attorney's office now.
Yeah.
There's probably not a lot of investigating going on because they're letting everybody out of jail.
Yeah, yeah. That and the Cook County Jail. I mean, I see all these Cook County, the correctional officers walking in there, and like, why are they, why do they need all these people that there's nobody in the jail?
Yeah.
But I don't know where that's going to go. You can't just keep letting these people out of jail.
Yeah.
It's going to have to stop.
It's insane.
At some point, yeah.
And, we had Pat O'Brien on the show a couple of times. Mm-hmm. I still can't believe he didn't win. You know, give me a break. Because we're rooting for him, I got to tell you. Is he still with the? Did he stay with the state's attorney's office, Pat?
I don't think Pat's. No, he's not with the. I think he left the state's attorney's office a long time ago.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, I think he went on his own. I think he actually was a judge.
Oh, that's right. He was a judge.
Right, and he left. Then he went to a practice, I believe, and decided to run. And I thought he was going to win too, but you know,
it's Chicago.
You know, it's Chicago. It's Chicago County and Chicago State.
Now, you know, did you ever see the movie The Untouchables?
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember the Sean Connery character?
Oh, yeah.
Talking about the Chicago way.
That's my grandfather.
Yeah.
That's my grandfather.
Yeah. Was he a copper?
My grandfather's a policeman. He was a World War II vet, and he was a policeman.
No kidding.
Yeah. He didn't tell any stories at all until I went out to Vegas the year he had passed away, and I got an earful.
Oh, from his old pals and stuff?
No, from him.
Oh, from him.
He didn't talk his whole life.
He
wouldn't
talk. He died,
he wasn't dying.
Oh.
I think he just knew he was dying.
Yeah.
Because he had just lost his wife. My grandma had just passed away.
Yeah.
And I went to Vegas, you know, to visit him. And this is a man that saying hello was a lot.
Yeah.
You know, hello was usually you call that a conversation. But he just would tell me story after story in Chicago about what, you know, what they did.
Yeah.
Some of the stories. And they were incredible stories. I mean, they were. Any Hollywood producer would love to hear these stories.
It's interesting. If you say Chicago, because there's two levels of crime. There's the street crime, and then you got the political crime.
Right.
That, you know, it's like two different levels. And you if you beat one, you may not beat the other. It's
right.
Frustrating, I would imagine, especially for a street cop.
Right. Well, I think the street cop's the one that always takes the beating.
Yeah.
I mean, he you know, there's so many examples recently of coppers getting in trouble for something, and then you look at the upper echelon in police departments and also at politicians.
Yes.
They screw up, and it seems to go away quickly.
Oh yeah,
you know, it seems to go away, but then you get some grunt, you know, a copper that, you know, is taking care of a family, and all of a sudden, but they won't let it go. The media's on them, and then you know, sooner or later they're going to get you.
That's terrible. And what about this Jussie Smollett? I'm waiting for that little piece of crap to go to jail.
What a story that was.
Oh, huh? My God. But you notice how that whole thing has just gone away.
Just gone away. Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, of course.
Actually, we had a copper on the show, Bill Hennigan, who was a burglary detective, and he was pretty funny. He was one of the first guys to cover that case. He had, that was his beat down there by... We used to do the show at Lizzie McNeil's over, you know, and that incident, that supposed racial and homophobic incident took place like a half a block away, and it was all BS.
Guys wearing MAGA hats in Chicago.
Yeah.
That's everywhere.
Hey, I was a Trump fan, and I never wore a MAGA hat. I know that didn't happen. Okay, so let's give a shout-out to your family. Your wife, Angie, is here tonight. How many kids you got?
Three.
Three kids. Two are police?
Two. Jimmy and Jack are police officers, and my daughter Caitlin's a teacher at Mount Carmel.
Well, that's like being the police.
Yeah. Well, she's tougher than both my
sons.
Anyway.
Yeah. And how long have they been on the force, your sons?
My son Jimmy's got 13 years, and my son Jack's got 3 years, yeah.
Okay, wow.
Yeah, he got on when he was like 13.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. Now, do you get residuals from the Jerry Springer show?
No. Well, it was funny. The only residuals I ever got was when we were on Letterman and Jay Leno. They would send me a residual check in the mail for like 75 cents.
What were you guys doing on there?
They just had us. They had Jerry was a guest.
Yeah.
And then they had us in the front row, like we would be at the Springer show.
Oh, yeah, like the security.
And they kept referring to us. And I think I said two words or something like that, so they had to keep paying me. But it was never more than $10. I got paid the first time I got paid. Yeah. But after that, it was like $10, $15, you know.
Now, you traveled with him a lot.
Yes, a lot.
All over the country?
Yeah, all over. We went to other countries and Jamaica.
Did he get threatened a lot or anything?
No, just the opposite. I didn't. Well, I would make reports up saying he was getting threatened all the time. Job security. But everywhere he went, everyone loved him.
Oh,
and,
really?
Yeah, there was no problems, yeah. Everywhere he went.
You know, there was a big thing at Channel 5 when they were going to bring him on and make him a newsreader, and Carol Marine and...
They went nuts.
Oh, they were like, oh, how... Yeah. don't besmirch our journalistic.
How about that?
BS. Give me a break.
Yeah.
But they got away with it. You know, he didn't. You know.
Well, they were going to bring it. They brought him in front of the
Ron
city council. Ron
Majors,
right?
And Carol Marie. They said, "We're walking.
We're going to leave." They made a big show out of it.
Yeah.
Because journalism is so truthful.
Oh, what a bunch
and
of
so
crap.
Honorable. Yeah.
Okay. Any final words you want to give to the audience? Mostly police officers.
Yeah,
just
tell my brothers and sisters out there to be careful.
Yeah.
You know, tread lightly. I mean, you got to, you know, listen to the older coppers. Listen to
That's
your conscience.
That's good advice, actually,
yeah,
right there.
Listen. Don't be some ranger out there trying to make things happen.
Yeah.
You can't be aggressive anymore.
No.
And it's sad to say, like I said, because there are real victims out there, but you got to take care of yourself and your family.
Yeah.
And no one's going to support you. If it's not Johnny Catanzaro looking after you, or there still are some good bosses out there,
yeah.
But they're far and few, you're on your own. And if you're on your own, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
So I just want, you know, the coppers out there to be careful.
Are you a member of the Emerald Society?
No.
Come on!
I'm not. I was. I was for about 10, 15 years, and I didn't renew my my dues, and just slip past me.
At 50 bucks, that'll break you.
It'll kill you.
Well, we promote them because they've been good to us. So
I like going to their party, their St. Patrick Day party.
Oh, yeah. They're the best.
Fun. Yeah.
And I understand you spoke to my friend Jeff Lang, who's an Emerald Society guy.
I did. Jeff, we had a long conversation.
He's quite the character.
Yes, he is.
But he's one of the, I think he's vice president of the Emerald Society or something. He's been very good to us. All right, so Jimmy Sherlock, what do you see in the future? How long are you going to hang around?
I'm going to stay 5 more years.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. I got a great partner right now that I'm working with, Mike Bacardo. And,
no relation to Jimmy Bacardo. Did you know Jimmy
this
Steaks?
Is Bacardo.
Oh, Bacardo. Okay.
Bacardo, yeah. No, he was a copper for 33 years. And him and I were hired the same day for the state's office, and we've been together, you know, since day one. So it's been a great relationship. And once again, I got lucky that I have a great partner.
Do you guys do felony review? Is that part of it?
No, I don't have anything to do with them.
What's felony review?
So felony review is obviously state attorneys, but what they'll do is they'll respond to an area to investigate a crime. If somebody gets arrested for, you know, whatever felony it is, the detectives do their job, and then they present it to the state's attorneys. Felony
who
review.
Decide if they're going to charge.
And then they decide if they're going to charge or not, correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you guys are bringing on after that.
Yeah, what I do, Julie, is... What my job right now is, I'm investigating real-time cases right now.
Yeah.
I'm assisting a unit. It's called the Gun Crime Unit.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm assisting them with real-time crimes.
Yeah.
So all we're like a conduit from the state attorney's office to the CPD.
Yeah.
So they're taking advantage of us because we, you know, obviously we're former, you know, CPD coppers. And they like the fact that we haven't been gone too long.
Yeah.
So we still have a lot of contact. So we're able to, you know, smooth things out.
You know the ropes.
Yeah, we know the ropes. We still know a lot of the bosses. So we're able to, you know, we walk in somewhere where, you know, if you say you're a state attorney investigator, sometimes they might close the door on you.
Yeah.
But they know who we are, so they accept us.
I can imagine you walking in a door, nobody's going to try and close the door on you. How tall are you?
6'1".
Oh, okay, because you come across as a big dude.
No.
Former Purdue Mount Carmel star. Yeah. All right, well, thanks for doing what you do. Yeah, stay holy. Safe.
Yeah, thank you.
I want you to know how much we respect and admire you and all our friends on the police and the Cook County and all law enforcement and all Irish first responders. You guys are doing a hell of a job.
Thank you.
Don't get discouraged and keep doing what you're doing. Okay, we're going to take a little break here on Hibernian Radio and be right back after these messages from our friends.
Flood Brothers Disposal was started over 90 years ago by their grandfather. With more than 20 family members still involved with day-to-day operations, the Floods are service-oriented and believe that the right way is the only way to do something. Flood Brothers are price competitive and still offer the personal touch in an industry-trending corporate. For client-centric service without all of that corporate garbage, call Flood Brothers today for a quote on your solid waste recycling and yard waste collection services. Call Bob Flood today at 630-261-0400 or go online at floodbrothersdisposal.com. Welcome back to the Flood Brothers.
Irish American News has been bringing you the news important to the Irish in Chicagoland for over 40 years. If you like mostly good news and information from all aspects of the Irish community, check out Irish American News. To advertise or subscribe, call our friend Cliff Carlson at 847-872-0700 or email him at cliff@irishamericannews.com. Irish American News, we've always been green.
On the death walk of saloons that decorate Western Avenue, only the Cork and Kerry Irish Pub, the soul of Beverly, sits right on a 50-yard line of Chicago's Southside Irish St. Patrick's Day Parade at 106th and Western. Generations of Southside Irish have quenched their thirst in the Cork, snuggling up to memories of family, faith, and fierce loyalty to friends. It's the jewel of this neighborhood where we celebrated weddings, christenings, wakes, and unforgettable victories. Proprietors Bill Guidy and Mike Fitzpatrick, now celebrating 20 years in business, welcome you home for a cold brew, to share a good story, or help you throw one hell of a party. With over 20 beers on tap and a full bar for your pleasure, this is the spot you can sink a root and get your Irish on. Cork has plenty of seating, from our private event rooms to our 300-person beer garden. Our interior space brings you back to the homeland of Ireland with our vintage photos and authentic Irish decor and Chicago memories of the good old days. So say hello to a stranger, make a new friend, fall in love, or just enjoy the company of people you forgot you knew. The Cork and Kerry continues the Southside tradition parents and grandparents brought here from the old country. Come on by the Cork and Kerry and get some. The Cork and Kerry Irish Pub, 10614 Southwestern Avenue, for private parties, just pals hanging out, or intimate cocktail rendezvous. Come on home to the south side of Chicago at the Cork and Kerry.
McCann's Irish Oatmeal. We've been warming the hearts, minds, and souls of the most discriminating oatmeal lovers for over 150 years. From the family farm to your table. Enjoy the whole grain goodness of McCann's Irish Oatmeal today, available at your local grocery store.
And we're back on Hibernian Radio. Hey, thanks to Jimmy Sherlock. What a great guest. And it's so great to be back here once again at the Cork and Kerry Irish Pub, 10614 Southwestern Avenue. And you know, Billy, whenever I'm walking down Western Avenue, I look in the window of Ken's or Wrong's or Hart's or Cork and Kerry, and I see the ghost of my old pal Jimmy Goff through the mist, and he says to me, "Hey, Hooley, who died?" Okay, Donald Corcoran, age 80, resident of the southwest side of Chicago, the Cleary neighborhood, beloved husband of Carol Ann, and the father of Mary, Daniel, and Carol Marie. Donald was born in Killarney, Ireland, and he moved to Chicago at the age of 19. He always maintained a love of his Irish heritage and Irish music. Donald was an extremely talented singer and softball coach at Lawler Park. Took great delight in playing the lottery. So do I. Especially of his scratch-off tickets. In his younger years, he was a member of the Ancient Order of Hibernians and Irish Club. Well, we know that. Donald was a longtime faithful member of St. Symphorosa Parish, where he was also a member of the Super Club. God rest his lovely soul, Donald Corcoran. Also, Eileen Nana Gaughan, aged 92, born in Fala, Belmullet, County Mayo. Mayo, God help us. Beloved wife of the late Eamon, and the loving mother of Angela, the late Mary, the late Thomas, Eamon, and Patrick. God rest her lovely soul, Eileen Gaughan, 92. An old friend of ours, Vera Kelly, only 52. She's a great actress here in Chicago, but originally from Ireland. Just really sad that she had been going through a lot of health issues for the last 4 years with leukemia. I saw her in a couple of plays, particularly one I saw up on the north side with Jimmy Ronan. Just a wonderful actress. Vera was a very, very special kind of lady, and I've known quite a few actresses in my day, and she's one of the best. So God rest her lovely soul. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made to Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. And Vera's expressed wishes are to have her ashes scattered into the Atlantic Ocean from the cliffs of Moher, County Clare, Ireland. God rest her soul, Vera Kelly. Jerry Ahern, Michael Jerry Gerard Ahern, beloved son of the late John, Jack, and Eileen, brother of Billy, Jimmy, Patty, Elma, Tessie, and the late Philomena, John, and Daniel. He's going to be buried in his native Abbey Field, County Limerick, Ireland. God rest his soul, Michael Ahern. And Barbara Maher Vedroliak, her name was Maher. She must have married a Vedroliak. Barbara had a great Irish wit and loving, playful spirit. She lived a large life filled with family and friends. She exuded class and charm, was always the bright light in the room. Always an optimist, living by her motto, remember the best, forget the rest. Barbara survived by her famine. Catherine Vedroliak, Barbara Dorgan, Nancy Marijan, Karen, and Mary Beth Vedroliak. God rest her soul, Barbara Maher Vedroliak. And finally, was it finally? Yes. James Heenan, Jimmy Heenan, age 82, a United States Army veteran, husband of Anna Marie and the late Josephine. He had two wives. The devoted father of James, Colleen, Michael, and Paul. God rest his soul, James Heenan. And he was waked, and the funeral arrangements were handled by Sheehy's, where all the right people go. Okay, Billy, we can close up the crypt. And when we return, we have a very special guest who's dropped by. So we'll be right back after these messages from our friends. With a history going all the way back to 1896, the International Union of Operating Engineers has continued to protect workers and their families with loyalty and brotherhood. Local 150 has continued to thrive through economic booms and busts with careful training and aggressive organizing. Under the leadership of President and Business Manager Jim Sweeney, Local 150 has implemented programs and action plans to create work, protect benefits, and keep members working. And they've been helping the Irish-American community of Chicagoland for just as long. The Hibernian Radio Show is proud to be associated with Jim Sweeney and Local 150, and we salute the continuing efforts of the International Union of Operating Engineers and their support of Irish and Irish-American families now and in the future. Thanks to Local 150. When your family has suffered a loss, there's one family I know who will be there for you. Robert J. Sheehy & Sons Funeral Homes are third-generation, family-owned and operated. The Sheehy family has dedicated their lives serving families throughout Chicago and the southwest suburbs. The Robert J. Sheehy & Sons Funeral Home was incorporated in 1913 as a storefront at 76th and Halsted in Chicago. At the time, this was one of the few standalone funeral homes of its kind and was to be the first of many to come bearing the Sheehy name. The founder, Roger Sheehy Sr., was soon joined in business by his three sons, Roger Jr., Jack, and Bob. This trademark of service is evident 98 years later, as Bob and Jim Sheehy, third generation, own and operate two locations in Orland Park and Burbank. At Sheehy's, the name on their sign outside the funeral home means something. For them, it's very important that everyone be treated as if they were family, friend, or neighbor, as they very well could be. When my brother Willie died a few years ago, the Sheehys took very good care of our family. And you know, you never forget something like that. Their entire staff cares about each and every family they serve. Every detail is handled in a professional and personal manner. On a daily basis, the directors Bill Kiley, Mike LaRock, and John Sullivan, and the rest of the staff take great pride in their work, serving families as if they were their own. Bob Sheehy will tell you, we pride ourselves on offering the highest level of professionalism with every family we serve. Robert J. Sheehy & Sons Funeral Homes, here for you since 1913.
Irish American News has been bringing you the news important to the Irish in Chicagoland for over 40 years. If you like mostly good news and information from all aspects of the Irish community, check out Irish American News. To advertise or subscribe, call our friend Cliff Carlson at 847-872-0700 or email him at cliff@irishamericannews.com. Irish American News, we've always been green.
So Southsiders have always known where to get the best pizza on earth, Fox's Pizza. For over a half century, the Fox family has been creating that delicious thin crust za that your mouth will tell you, this can only be Fox's. It's a Chicago Beverly institution at 99th and Western, as well as in Orland Park, where they combine delicious food with an Irish pub ambiance. You got the best of both worlds. Still owned by Tom and Frank Fox, whose mom and dad, Frank and Teresa, bought the Western location from Al Capone's sister back in 1964. They opened the doors in Orland at 73 at 143rd and Ravinia Avenue. You'll recognize the stone turrets of their Irish castle, whose great times have been celebrated for generations of Chicagoland Irish. Fox's is perfect for the whole family, pickup or delivery, or you can dine in, relax, and have a cocktail with your dinner, whether it's steak, ribs, chicken, or especially pizza. It's all good. Having a party? Fox's also does catering. Call Fox's in Beverly at 773-239-3212 or in Orland Park at 708-349-2111. They're proud sponsors of Hibernian Radio and all Irish first responders. Mention this show for a free toothpick. Gotta love that Fox's Pizza.
Flood Brothers Disposal was started over 90 years ago by their grandfather. With more than 20 family members still involved with day-to-day operations, the Floods are service-oriented and believe that the right way is the only way to do something. Flood Brothers are price competitive and still offer the personal touch in an industry-trending corporate. For client-centric service without all of that corporate garbage, call Flood Brothers today for a quote on your solid waste, recycling, and yard waste collection services. Call Bob Flood today at 630-261-0400 or go online at floodbrothersdisposal.com. Welcome back to the Flood Brothers.
And we're back on Hibernian Radio. So glad to have you all with us. Hey, we're a very special guest here tonight. Kind of popped in to see his pal, Jimmy Sherlock. We have the one and only honorary Irishman and President FOP Lodge 7, John Kenton Zara. John, welcome back to the show, pal.
Mike, I told you I had a little Irish blood in me.
Yeah, it was pig Irish, I believe is the expression you used.
That was my mom's term. Okay. God love her.
All right, so last time we talked, the hits just keep on coming.
They certainly do. No rest for the wicked, they say.
No, it's terrible. And I got to tell you, we're with you. This is baloney. And it's a tough, tough time. And one of the things we were just talking about before during the break, when I told Jimmy about their expression, somebody said, if we stop, what was it? They win. Right?
They win. Yeah. And it was, you know, he
mentioned bad guys
to Scott Rakovich, yeah, one of his old partners, was the one who actually said that to me when I was recounting the story. You know,
keep talking.
We were having a discussion about the, which is very applicable today, the mindset of pulling back and stop doing proactive police work that are going to get you jammed up in one way or another, and the pros and cons of that mindset. And Rakovich, Rock to his credit, was like, you can't do that.
He's
you
right.
Give up, they win.
God bless
and they
him.
Get the city, and you yeah can't let them win.
Is he any relation to Katie Rakovich?
That I don't know. Jimmy, yeah, I don't know.
Billy would. Okay. A little intern we had years ago who was pretty funny. Well, good, John Rakovich, God bless him for saying that.
Scott.
Scott, okay. Scott Rakovich. Well, he's right.
Because, he is.
You know, we're on the brink of total disaster right now. It's awful.
Dangerously close to this whole state being Detroit.
Yeah, and we were talking about that last week. We had Pat Kana on the show, and they had passed that bill at 3 in the morning, the defund the police bill, sneaky little jerks that they are. I guess, but the governor has not signed that yet?
The governor has not signed it yet. So, I find it at least somewhat reassuring. It hasn't been signed yet. That tells me there's some reservations.
Storm the phone lines,
it
folks.
Was also shocking that the Tribune and the Sun-Times both came out and said he should veto it.
Did they really?
They did.
That's a big surprise.
Exactly.
Because the Tribune is commie city.
Anybody with common sense and some simple logic understands the dynamic by which that law was passed is not the proper way to do it.
Yeah.
It was the battle cry our law enforcement coalition has had from day one, all summer long, about how that needed to be a process. And again, for that to be dropped 3 days prior to that lame duck session,
yeah,
to digest 600 plus pages.
Yeah, it was like this big, gigantic thing, and they slapped it onto something else, too, basically.
It was a bunch of piles of crap thrown on top of a heap of a pile of crap and dressed up with a House bill number. I mean, that's what it was. Yeah. There was no foresight. There was no thought. Even in the middle of the night when they merged two separate bills, 163 and 841, into that disgusting monster of 3653, there is so much contradictory language within that bill that still doesn't make any sense.
Right.
The politicians who championed that bill could not even defend what it really meant and what effects it was going to have on law enforcement, and Jimmy touched on it, the citizens and the victims.
Yeah.
The poor people who always get forgotten in this equation are the victims, who are basically prisoners inside their own home in these neighborhoods. It's just disgusting. But at the goal, I don't even know if you can say a goal, was criminal justice reform. Well, their version of that was handing the keys to the criminals to this city.
Who were the politicians that championed that bill? You know, I can't remember.
Well, I mean, on the Senate side, it was L.G. Sims, and on the House side, it was Justin Slaughter. You know, Senator Lightford is just as responsible. I mean, it was the Black Caucus agenda. There was no hiding it. So this isn't a race thing. They made it a race thing from day one.
Yeah.
And not only that, but, you know, your countrymen, the former speaker now.
Oh, Madigan.
He didn't have to call that lame duck session.
No.
But he did. Because he was trying to shore up his votes to be speaker one more term.
Yeah.
So that kind of falls on his doorstep a little bit there. But this legislation had been around in one form or another for over 2 years. And it just kind of kept growing. The pile of crap kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
Nobody ever stopped and said, what does that really mean? What effect is that going to have a year, 5, 10 years from now?
Yeah.
And one of the simplest things, and this is the mindset our mayor has. When that lame duck session was going on, our coalition had so many Zoom meetings, emails, telephone conference calls, you name it. But a light bulb went off in my head about, I'm thinking a year, 5 years, 10 years down the road, what is our police department going to look like? So I call the guys at the pension board, and I have them give me a spreadsheet of how many officers we have, what years of service they have, how old they are, et cetera. So I came up with the numbers of there's a little over 2,500 officers right now who have 20 years of service and are 50 years old or older and can collect a check tomorrow. Literally walk away, say, screw it, I'm done.
Yeah.
There's a little over 3,000 that have 20 years of service regardless of age. That would be 3,000 less officers paying into a pension fund that's already funded at 24%. It's already upside down by 1,200 plus officers collecting checks as opposed to paying into it. And you're putting this financial burden on top of there. And just for tangible numbers that people need to understand, the pension fund pays out about $70 million a month in annuity payments, totally. You could say at the average annuity of about $5,500 a month, you add another 1,000 officers on there, or 1,200 officers, you're looking at $7 million more a month. You double that. If everybody walked away, you're looking at about $15 million more a month. The fund's going to have to pay out, and revenue that's not coming into the fund. It would bankrupt the system in time. It absolutely would, unless they're going to start raising taxes 40, 50%.
They'll do that.
I brought this to the mayor's attention
and
the mayor's attorney's attention, and the response was quite simple. I find it troubling that you're bringing this to my attention at the ninth hour. Maybe you'll learn that burning bridges isn't the best thing for your members.
Are you kidding?
So it's all about personal thing. It isn't about the possibility of what these things can do.
Yeah.
It's all about, I'm going to teach you a lesson.
Yeah.
That's the mind. They don't care.
To hell with the city.
To hell with the city and its residents. Not only the police, but the taxpayers who are going to have to foot the bill to those guaranteed, constitutionally protected promises that were made in pension.
We're in a bad situation.
It's pretty scary. But again, the spring session's right around the corner. We have the ability to unwind a lot of this crap.
And everybody should call Pritzker's office and say,
sign the bill.
Yeah.
Well, he has to veto it. Because if he doesn't sign it within 60 days, it automatically takes effect.
Oh, good. Oh, so, no, we don't want that.
No, we don't want that. So he needs to veto it.
Yeah.
And you know, the coalition, we got a phenomenal group. The coalition was put together over a year ago. And it consists of Lodge 7, the state police president, the Joint Labor Council, the FOP state president, the chiefs of police, and the sheriff's association, along with the lobbyists. So we have 250 plus years of law enforcement experience among this group plus. We put forth what we thought were modernization plans as far as we hear the cries. We understand what people are saying about the police. We don't agree with it 100%, but we don't disagree 100% either. There's always room for improvement as a profession. So we came up with what we thought were practical sense approaches and laws and even wording language to make that a reality. We were purposely left out of the equation. The AG's office, the governor's office, the Black Caucus wanted nothing to do with the FOP.
No kidding.
On Ledge 7 level, the state police, the state president, nothing. The only people they let participate in their talks, when they talk about law enforcement participation, is the sheriffs and the chiefs. That's it. Did they put forth some of the things we thought? Yes. But again, we had no direct involvement in any of these conversations whatsoever. If they say otherwise, they're absolutely lying, and they should charge themselves with the Class 3 felony like they're trying to charge the police with.
And the other thing is, they're going nuts with these carjackings. What, 150% they've increased? It's like, it's scary.
It's not about the victims. And I'll tell you a quick anecdote that people can really digest simply about this law and what would happen if it wasn't changed going forward.
Yeah.
We had contract negotiations yesterday, and the lead attorney for the city is Jim Franzik. And I said, it's kind of surprising to hear that the lead attorney for the city, his number two guy, the mayor's labor attorney, had not taken any effort to digest the ramifications of this bill that they helped champion because they wanted it. It obviously gave the city cover when it came to the contract negotiations. It took away a lot of the protections that the city was trying to get in negotiations. They made their job easier. But I said, just understand this, since you didn't read the bill and understand what it really means. July 1st, Mr. Franzik, I'm going to come to your office. I'm going to sit in your lobby. I'm just going to pull out my phone and start diddling around on my phone. Your assistant or secretary is going to come and say, John, you got to go. I'm going to say, I'm not leaving. You're going to come out and say, John, what are you doing? You got to go. I'm going to say, F you. I'm not leaving. Call the police. You're going to call the police. The police are going to show up. They're going to say, John, leave. No, I'm sorry. I don't mean to put you in the middle, but I'm not leaving. And guess what's going to happen? They're going to ask for my ID. They're going to write me a ticket with a court date. And then they're going to ask me to leave again. And I'm going to still tell them no. They're going to say, okay, turn around, get on an elevator and leave. Do you know why? Because you can't arrest somebody for a Class B misdemeanor anymore. Trespassing is a Class B misdemeanor. They could write me 50 tickets in a day, and I'm still going to sit in your lobby, and there's nothing anybody could do. You're just going to have to deal with that. So that's the stupidity and just lack of foresight in this language that people don't get. One more example I gave them.
Did you say this to these
I people? I did.
What did they say? What did they say?
They're looking at me like they have no idea. He's like, are you serious? One more simple example.
1 minute.
Okay, real quick. I go and I shoot Mike Houlihan. 2 hours later, Jimmy Sherlock sees me walking down the street.
Yeah.
There's still not a warrant out for my arrest. He knows who I am. He knows I was named as your offender that killed you.
Yeah.
He cannot even use force to arrest me because the felony did not just occur. He could basically say, John, stop. F you. I take off running. He basically has to let me go because he knows who I am.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how stupid.
Unbelievable.
There was no thought put in this whatsoever. It was just today's the rent is due. That was the reoccurring theme down in Springfield that they put pressure on all the white legislators. And it was pressure. If you F us, you'll never get a black vote again, is what the Black Caucus told every single one of them in the Democratic Caucus, hour after hour, until they all caved.
Well, that's as just we close the show, you would never shoot Mike Houlihan, though.
No, I wouldn't shoot anyone. I hope I never have to shoot anybody.
Thank you, pal.
No, thank you
really
for your
really appreciate you coming
appreciate
on the show.
You
got a seat here anytime. We're going to take it up. Thanks, everybody, for listening. God bless you all. And you too, John Contanzara. And we'll see you next week. See you later. Bye.
Well, I look down the road and I wonder. Up my shoes.